Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Stephen Wright, multi-award-winning journalist and associate news editor of the Daily Mail. After joining the paper's crime desk in 1996, he became crime editor and in 2010 associate news editor. During this time, he reported on a number of high-profile cases, including the Soho murders and the Harold Shipman case. His career has been dominated by the death of Stephen Lawrence, the then unsolved murder he first covered in 1997. He spearheaded the Daily Mail's Justice for Stephen campaign, and his dogged reporting became central to the inquiry into the case and also the killer's convictions in 2012. Stephen, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure, glad to be here.
Well, Stephen, let's start with Stephen Lawrence then, if we may. Tell us about how that whole case came to be on your radar and walk us through the whole journey.
Well, in 1996, I joined a crime desk, as you just spelt out in the opening there, and I was looking at the murder of a doctor called Joan Francisco in North London. It happened a year or so earlier. And I got to know a lawyer for the family of the victim. They were disappointed with how the Met had handled her murder. And the lawyer for the family, she was a partner of Imran Khan, the lawyer for the Lawrence family at the time. I wasn't taking any close interest in the Lawrence case at that time. But Imran kept telling me, you know, you should really look at the case. And so I did my sort of own research, investigations, and fast forward to January, I think it was, in January, February 1997, and there was the inquest into Stephen's murder when the five prime suspects basically put two fingers up at justice and said nothing. And off the back of that, the editor did our famous front page. The campaign was launched the next day, basically.
So you presumably shared your editor's huge sense of outrage that these guys had got away with it.
Yeah, I think any decent person would. Obviously, it didn't have the profile then. The inquest was high profile, but I got involved. The profile of the case just went tenfold up thereafter. And the outrage of the public was there to see.
What came next then?
Well, the day after the famous front page, Daily Mail front page, calling them murderers, I got called into executive's office and was told basically, you know, we want to keep this going. We're going to launch a campaign. You know, to be a young reporter, asked or told basically, this is your story, it was a great opportunity. So we day after day for weeks, we're running stories about Stephen's murder, the injustice of it. We obtained some video of the two or three of the suspects, undercover police video, which was horrifying. And of course, there was the danger that there might be some legal action against the paper. The editor, Paul Dacre, had previously spoken about that. It was a very real fear. Thankfully, that didn't happen. There was no action. And the campaign went on. We obviously forged a close relationship with the families.
And at that moment, did you have a sense that, you know, just how far this was going to go and just how deep it went? Because, I mean, you got, to say the least, pushback from all sides, really, didn't you?
Yeah.
Not least including the Met.
Yeah, well, I didn't know what was going to happen. I don't think, you know, I'm not going to reinvent history. It was a campaign for justice initially. And you go where the story takes you, like in any story, you go where the story takes you. And it took us into areas which I wasn't expecting us to go into. I was basically a new crime reporter at the time, but I'd been in the job a year. And I was trying to get contacts. The Police Federation weren't happy with my reporting. They thought that it was unfair. They thought it was someone not to be trusted, that the police had got it right. That was difficult. I looked at one of the prime suspects who was ultimately convicted of murder, David Norris. His dad was a notorious gangster, Clifford Norris. And I remember someone calling me late at night. I was looking at a court case where he'd been controversially acquitted. I got a call from someone who had witnessed that court case. There was something really bad had happened. You know, he should have been convicted of attempted murder. He hadn't been. And I basically got a warning just to be careful about Clifford Norris. He was in jail, I think, at the time, but just to be careful about upsetting the family too much. I don't think, looking back, that there was anything to be scared of. But that night, I do recall, my car was parked on the fifth floor of the multi-storey next to the Daily Mail. And it was like a scene from All the Presidents of Men, sort of. I don't want to sound over-dramatic, but I was alone about 10:30. My car was on the top floor. And I suddenly thought about what that person had just told me a couple of hours earlier, to be careful. And it was quite a chilling moment, really. And that probably an overreaction. There's the risks you take. But, you know, they were bad people. And they were surrounded by bad people.
And you must have had a really strong sense of justice that you had to stand up for Stephen's memory on this.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we wanted to, as a paper, I mean, as a journalist, we wanted to do all we could. And, you know, there were other... It wasn't just about the Daily Mail.
Do you think the Met just did a half-assed job? And I know there's the claims of institutional racism and so on, but what do you think was the fundamental problem?
I think it was a very poor investigation.
Because Stephen was black?
That is a thing I've thought about many times over the years. There was an element, clearly there was an element of that, I would agree. But also I think it was a very poor investigation. And, I mean, I wouldn't dispute the findings of the McPherson inquiry later. No way. I don't think it was just about Stephen being black. I think it was just an appalling investigation. And to put that in context, I would say that there have been worse investigations where the police have got justice. I think it was a lot of good came out of Stephen's terrible, terrible murder. The Met were very sloppy, and in the aftermath of that case, they were in denial about what they'd got wrong, how sloppy they were, how poor they were to the family, and, you know, senior police officers going ahead with weekends off, handing over the baton to another officer. No one took ownership of that case in the early days. It was eminent. I agree with Doreen Neville, the lawyers. It was an eminently solvable case, but for those terrible errors and in the early days of the inquiry. So, yeah, it was shocking. And I should also, just coming back to me now, Paul, that I remember there was, in late 97, there was Kent Police did an investigation into a Lawrence case on behalf of the police watchdog, I think it was the Police Complaints Authority at the time. And I was called up to meet Paul Condon, the then commissioner, and had a one-to-one with him. Paul was really shocked. Previously, there'd been a whitewash into the report into the Lawrence case, which has given the Met and senior officers a clean bill of health. I think he was really, really shocked about how bad it was. I think that's the first time he really got it, and the Met got it. And, of course, what came out in the McPherson inquiry was even worse.
And you became close to the Lawrence family over the years.
Well, I think we've got a good professional relationship with them. I mean, I have, you know, got on well. I wouldn't say, you know, I think they are appreciative of what the paper's done. As far as I'm concerned, just doing our jobs. Some of my colleagues enjoy good relations, have done over the years. You know, we have a real respect for their dignity and courage and strength. It hasn't been easy for them. A good relationship and good professional relationship. That's what I hope. I hope that continues.
Do you think the Met have learned from this now? Do you think they'd make the same mistake now, or do you think things have genuinely improved?
I think the police is a better place in terms of how we deal with the issues of race and diversity as a result of the Lawrence case. I would say they have. They're better. It's a bit of a cliche, but I think it's very true when successive commissioners say that the Metropolitan Police today is far more representative of London and Londoners, and it is. And that is one of the benefits, or one of the positive things which has come out of the Lawrence case. You know, the Met and other police forces are far more modern and much more sensitive to the needs of different communities. I think that's a real positive.
Do you enjoy writing about crime, if that's not a silly question? How did you get into this? I mean, we've had Mark Williams-Thomas sitting there. We've got Martin Brunt coming on soon. You know, we've got a runner at the moment of kind of crime reporters. But what you're doing is incredibly important. But it's also you're dealing with human tragedy on a moment-by-moment basis.
Yeah, I mean, I stumbled into it, really. I was a young reporter. I mean, I joined the staff of the Mail in November 1993.
So it's a long time ago.
Yeah, a few months. I got offered the job. I'd been sent down as a young reporter to Southend. A gay serial killer, Colin Ireland, had just been caught, and I was sent down there as the leg man for our distinguished crime correspondent Peter Rose. And I was perceived to have done well on that job, doing background on the case, and got a job offer a few months later. I was about to leave the paper because I didn't really want to carry on shifting or doing contracts.
So Daily Mail man and boy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I a few months later, February 1994, got a call at midnight from the news desk. Can you go down to Gloucester tomorrow? A couple of bodies have been found in the garden. I went down there, and I came back about 6 weeks later to London. Obviously, it was the Fred and Rose West case. So when I went down there, and the story just got bigger and bigger. It was an extraordinary case to cover as a young reporter.
Did you meet Fred and Rose?
No. I mean, Fred was already in custody. Rose was in a safe house for a few weeks.
Because the police initially believed at that point that she might have been
innocent. They wanted to gather the evidence. I mean, she was in a safe house, and clearly it was bugged to hell. And they were taking their time to gather the evidence to lay charges on her. But you know, you went from, within a few days, there were three bodies found, and then suddenly it went up to nine bodies, or nine confessions from Fred, and the story just got bigger and bigger. So look, I covered the West case. Other reporters came and went. I was fascinated by it. You know, as a young reporter, you want to work on big stories. And Fred killed himself on January the 1st, 95.
That was right. It was New Year's Day, wasn't it?
New Year's Day, yeah. I remember I'd been to the West End with my wife the night before. And I was sitting on a doorstep in Sussex, one of our photographers on another job, and I got a call from one of the people on the news desk. So Fred West has killed himself. I said, what? I rang one of the senior detectives on the case. We were allowed to ring detectives in those days.
And, I'll come to that shortly.
Yeah, yeah. And he was just having his New Year's Day roast. I mean, thankfully, I mean, he took my call and said, yeah, it's true. And I had to really rush back to London. And anyway, look, fast forward a few months I covered the trial at Winchester in the autumn of 95. A couple of weeks after that, there was a vacancy on the Daily Mail crime desk. I was the only person who applied. I'm glad about that, because I might not have got the job.
And how has it affected you as a person to cover all these quite horrible people doing quite horrible things? Because you don't strike me as a serial killer yourself, so
no.
I imagine you're not.
Funny you should say that, because I did cover the case of the serial killer Steve Wright.
Steve Wright.
It can be, you know, I with the West case, let's talk through three cases. The West case, pre-internet, and there was a lot of self-censorship going on. There was stuff we heard at that trial which no one should have to hear, let alone someone have to go through it, needless to say.
So depraved.
It was so disgusting. It was as vile and horrific as one can imagine. And, you know, I do think sometimes on the West case, what would happen now? Would some sort of freelance working for a website go down to court and just put everything up and it go around the world? So that was horrible. I remember there was some sniggering because the local council left some leaflets in the press room. And if you're affected by this trial, this is the number to call for counselling.
That's quite caring of them.
I thought it was, yeah. And it's like the macho thing of Fleet Street. So people say, oh, God, you know, down the pub, do you see that leaflet? You know, who on earth would take that up? And I thought, when I've got two daughters now who are the sort of age that the Wests would have targeted. That one didn't affect me, as horrific as it was. The two cases which have affected me over the years, I mean, I went to New York for 9/11. New York wasn't really a crime story. I mean, New York was a war zone. And I'm not a war reporter. You know, I dropped my eldest daughter off at nursery. Got one of the first planes to New York after we were allowed to fly directly into JFK. And then you're suddenly into this bloody war zone. And it was, you know, it was horrific. And I remember being grabbed by a woman who was looking for her husband. And she was holding up a picture of him with a child similar age to my younger daughter. And I found that quite very difficult to deal with. You're there to report, but you're there as a human being as well. And I found that really difficult. It affected me for a long, long time afterwards. And, you know, if you go to a big story like that, you're jet lagged, you know, Manhattan, I remember being awake at night, you know, the fire engines going everywhere, alarms going off everywhere. It's really tough. And, you know, it took me many years to really be quite open about that because, you know, we live in a business, we end up working in a business where it's difficult to be open sometimes. Actually, the best thing to do is talk about it. When you belatedly realise that, it's much easier. So taking sort of my own experience as a, you know, difficult case to cover, and 2 years ago, I was in Hong Kong for the trial of Rurik Jutting, Cambridge-educated banker, who murdered two prostitutes in the most horrific circumstances. I would call it a murder trial of the digital age because I had been out to cover the Jutting murders when he was first arrested 2 years earlier. But we didn't know just what those girls had gone through. I did something in that trial I've never done before. There were agency reporters there from AFP and Reuters. The opening of the prosecution was so disgusting. I put my pen down for 2 minutes. I couldn't, I've been a journalist 30 odd years, covering crime for a quarter of a century odd now. I could not believe that someone, a human being, was capable of doing what he did to those girls. And I remember some distinguished Daily Mail reporters, writers in the past, when they used to go and do colour, the descriptions of court cases, they often used to look at the defendant in the dock. And that's what I did then. And subsequently, we had a 45-minute audio of him torturing a woman. And that was played to court. Luckily, we only heard it. The poor jurors had to watch it. And thereafter, there are about 40 selfie videos of him glorifying in death. Sorry if I'm a bit macabre here, but the point I'm going to make is that that was difficult. And there were reporters from the international media who were in tears. But I mean, it was horrific, but the important thing was to talk about it afterwards. And people, you know, calling me, saying, that's bloody horrific. I said, yeah, it was actually.
You were there.
I was there. It was horrific. So, it can be difficult, but, you know, there's a lot of professional joy you can get out of the case as well, out of covering the crime cases as well.
We had Mark Williams-Thomas in that chair a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him at this kind of moment, hearing some horrific things that he'd said, it just struck me, you know, are there just some straight-up evil people in the world? And he said, yes, there is. But, you know, do you ever feel sorry for the people in the dock? Obviously, you feel sorry for the victims as well. How do you deal with that psychologically?
Yeah, I mean, I am struggling to think of a case where I've felt sorry for, you know, a psychopath or someone who's inflicted real, you know, horror on someone. I find it. There are times when you think, oh, I wonder if, and I hope I understand, sound like some sort of stereotypical Daily Mail reporter here, but you do sometimes think, I wonder if that person had a different upbringing, whether they had a stable family, whether things might have turned out differently. I have, you know, there was a case I covered in the late 90s, a girl called Sharon Carr, who was Britain's youngest murderess. She murdered, mutilated a hairdresser aged 16 when she was just 12. And you know, she was brought up in Belize and was killing animals and drinking blood, and her mum, you know, the evidence was, and our own research in Belize was that her mum wasn't really engaged to being a mother. So, I mean, something's obviously for a 12-year-old to murder and mutilate someone it was unprecedented and still is. She's Britain's youngest murderess. I mean, Mary Bell was not convicted of murder.
But you look at something like the Bulger Killers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel desperately sorry for poor Jamie's
parents.
Yeah,
of course, yeah.
She took her eyes off him for, like, 3 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, it could happen to anyone. Poor David Cameron left Nancy in the pub. It does happen.
Yes, of course.
But some of my friends have said, you know, lock them up, throw away the key. And then some of my other friends are like, you know, what they did was horrific, but they were themselves 10 and 11.
Yeah, they were 10, weren't they? So, yeah.
That still troubles me to this day, the Bulger case. Even now, decades later, I still think of poor Jamie.
I wasn't involved in that one, but obviously, and I've written about the case since.
And do you go into journalist mode then when you're writing about it? How does that work in terms of, because you are a human being, you are going to be affected by it, or do you kind of put that to one side for a few hours while you get the copy done, and then do you kind of reflect when you're shower or driving home?
I think depends what the type of story it is. You know, I use the injustice of a case as one of my motivating factors. So if I feel, I think on big stories, big cases, you want to feel the adrenaline and you want to feel passionate about it. But you have to do that in a professional sense. You know, if you don't do it in that way, then you're at risk of not doing the job properly. It's, it's trying to get that balance right between being a human being and doing a professional job.
Do you get contacted by the killers and by the people that are in the dock because they want to put their side forward? What, I don't even know what the ethics are of that. Some guy goes down for armed robbery and killing someone and then writes to you from prison saying, I want to put my side of the story. Do you go and see them?
To do an interview in prison, I think you, with a convicted person, then there have to be certain rules to do that. So they have to be not talking about, you know, whinging about what it's like in prison. They have to have a genuine, this is what I believe to be the case, or certainly was in the old days, that you have to be, they think they've been the victim of a miscarriage of justice, and you can go and talk to them about that. Some sneaky journalists sometimes go in and interview people, not revealing that they're journalists. I haven't done that, I might add. But I was doing an investigation in the mid-90s into the head teacher, Philip Lawrence, who was murdered outside school gates. Very high-profile case.
I remember it well.
Yeah.
Poor Mr. Lawrence.
And, so I was looking at his killer, Liarko Chindamo, and did a lot of work on that. And I think actually it's the only time I've been into prison to see someone. I went to see his dad, Massimo Chindamo, in Viterbo prison north of Rome. I found out his dad had gangland links and was a very dangerous man, and he was known as the Acid Man. Because he threw acid over people's faces who he didn't like.
Sounds a
lovely, gentleman, lovely man, yeah. So he was happy to. The Italian justice minister approved a request for me to go and see him in prison. Incredible. because Chindamo was boasting his dad was in the mafia and all that. So we went up there, and he was like Hannibal Lecter, and he had 4 guards come with him to meet me in the room. He demanded
to protect him or to protect
that's
you?
Right, I beg your pardon. Yeah, I don't know. They were to protect me, I suppose. Yeah, it was two. He was flanked by two guards on each side. He came into the special interview room, and he demanded about £500,000.
Idiot.
Yeah, for his interview, and I said, "Well,
no,
you're not going to have that." And I interviewed him for about 1 minute, enough to get a front page splash. I'm proud of my son, all that. Anyway, and I sent him on his way. And over 2 days, the trial ended. He liked the attention. His lawyer rang me from Rome. Mr. Chindamo is now happy to do the interview for free. I said, sorry, too late. And he got let out of prison later. 3 or 4 years later, the foreign editor called me over. He said, remember that bloke Chindamo you interviewed in prison 3 or 4 years ago? I said, yeah, he's been let out of prison. I said, oh, yeah, and? Oh, he's just been arrested for murder in Spain. So, Jesus. Yeah, he was a dangerous man. I better keep an eye on him.
Does that ever weigh heavy on you in a sense that sometimes in just doing straight coverage of what these criminals are doing, that in a sense they want that? That there's a strong movement in America that says the kind of rolling news reporting of school shootings is one of the things that actually the school shooters want. They want to see their name on the CNN ticker and you know, live outside. And that's one of the reasons why they do it. And they're talking about, you know, dialing down the coverage of these kind of school shootings because that's the very thing that they want. You mentioned there you covered the guy's father, and he actually quite liked the fact that he was
well,
a splash.
He did. Yeah, and that was but wasn't, you know, not something I intended. And I mean, I went there for good journalistic reasons, hopefully.
I'm not suggesting otherwise.
No. I'm just saying. But I think it's a valid point. There are some killers.
Because the Craze loved it. I remember reading about the Craze when I was a kid, that they loved being in the paper and being seen as celebrity gangsters of the East End.
Yeah, I think we have, you know, I'm always wary of us writing stories which might prompt copycat attacks. I think in particular with terrorism at the moment, you know, you've got young, influential, easily to be influenced, potential jihadis out there who get an idea. Of how to do something from what's in the papers or what have you. So I think we've got a real responsibility around that, not giving ideas, not, you know, there's a limit to, you know, we want to get the story out, but I think we've got responsibility. I'm struggling at the moment, Paul, to think about particular cases I've done, but it's something in the back of my mind. And, you know, because I'm an experienced journalist at the Mail, and it's up to people like me to, you know, raise those concerns in particular cases.
Do you cover terrorism differently to any other crime? Because, you know, if you've got acquisitive crime, like some lag that tries to rob the local Metro bank and goes in there with a shooter and he gets caught and he does 15 years, you know, fair enough. But, you know, when people are ideologically driven by religion, do you have to cover that differently? Because the killer might say, well, it's because Tony Blair invaded Iraq that I'm killing all of these people. Or do you just treat it as a straight crime story?
I think you treat it as a crime story.
Because they're still murderers.
Yeah, and I, you know, after led the Daily Mail's coverage of the 2005 terror attacks, and I remember there was a lot of hostile reaction. I think one of the assistant commissioners that met did a statement which was perceived by some, I will not comment, as being a bit woolly and not really describing them as what they were, which is murderous bastards. There's no justice, and I think the public and Daily Mail readers, dare I say it, what they wanted to hear was, we're going to catch these, you know, we're going to, well, we can't catch them, because well, at that stage, we didn't know that they'd blown themselves up. But so they didn't do it alone, there was a support network. And then there was another round of attacks, thankfully, mercifully, which weren't successful 2 weeks later. But no, I think, you know, the terrorists are murderers. And there's no justification for it. That's the bottom line, in my opinion.
Have you become a bit more fearful in your kind of personal dealings, given that you've been exposed to the dark side of humanity? I know you mentioned earlier about the car park incident as you were going up to the car park, but, you know, we've had Nick Ross in that chair a couple of years ago, and he used to present Crime Watch, and at the end of it he used to say, you know, do sleep well, don't have nightmares, and I'd be like, cheers, Nick, I am going to have a lot of nightmares, thanks, because you've just told me there's 20 killers and armed robbers on the loose, and they're probably going to come and get me.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm mindful of that. I am very much of the view that it's my choice to do the job. It's a job I enjoy, a job I have enjoyed. A lot of professional satisfaction to be got out of it if you do it well. It's always tried to do. But there are risks, and you have to use your judgment about what risks are worth taking. A few years ago, got a call out of the blue from a literary agent, saying, I've got a great idea for a book. Really would like to talk to you about it, a book idea. No, nothing in my contract says I can't go and talk to a literary agent about a potential book.
He said, the Mail's PR.
He said, the idea is that you write the unauthorised biography of Terry Adams and the Adams family. Ah, right, that's an interesting proposal, isn't it? No, I won't do that one. And I subsequently found out that other people had turned down that offer. So that one was not worth it. More recently, a couple of years ago, I did a series, exposing Albanian murdered fugitives. The first one went to Albania for the news desk to cover a high court case here. Chap who was fighting, a murderer, a double murderer who was fighting extradition back to Albania. So I did a big two-page spread on him. While I was in Albania, I got called aside by someone very senior in government and said, "We've got a real problem with Albanian murder fugitives in London. The Scotland Yard aren't sending them back to us." So I was given a name, and a couple of weeks later, myself and David Jones, a very experienced and very good colleague of mine, features, we found the notorious eye gouger, double murder fugitive. He'd been on the Interpol wanted list for 20 years.
You found him?
We found him. We found him in Boreham Wood.
And the Met couldn't?
No, they couldn't. Now, that was probably the most terrifying doorstep I've ever done. And I videoed it. At the last minute, I had a camera put on me. So we were 95% certain the eye gouger was in Boreham Wood. And David and I parked our cars down the end of the road. And it was a long walk. And I was thinking, oh, God.
Figuratively as well, yeah, as literally.
I didn't ring my
it's
wife.
Like the Green Mile.
I didn't, yeah. I think we were a bit nervous. He was definitely, he'd been staking out the address for a few days.
This is the chap who had a knife in his hall.
He came to the door. He came to the. He opened the door and there were two kitchen knives next to him. And he pretended to be a Kosovan refugee. And sort of played along. It's not me. He got the wrong person, you know, he said. And it was a very dramatic doorstep.
I can imagine.
But I say this, that it was our decision to do it. You know, we're two experienced journalists, very experienced journalists, and we walked up there and we knocked on the door. One of the reasons I did that, I've got distinguished colleagues who duck bullets in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I took the decision it was a risk worth taking. If I'd lost my arm, whatever, or worse in it, then that would have been my fault. I wouldn't have blamed anyone for it. So that was, but you know, you have to, if you're in the front line, on the front line, on those types of stories, and my adrenaline was certainly pumping.
I used to watch Roger Cook doorstep people on World in Action and all these kind of things, and my heart was in my mouth. I was a teenager thinking, don't knock on the door, Roger.
I like doorstepping people. I think it's a really it's an underappreciated skill.
We can't get the story just sending emails from your desk,
can you?
No, you
can't. And you can't get good stories from data leaks and data dumps and all that, you know, I think. So, I mean, just to finish out, he was arrested a couple of days later, and he's actually someone wrote some churlish piece in another paper about his front page. It's a very dramatic front page. You try to, you know, his wife, who waived her anonymity to the paper, she'd been raped by him in the UK, and, you know, it was a horrific case, and she was very glad that he was off the streets. And so were his victims' families over in Albania.
And society, as I am, as a citizen.
Yeah, he wasn't. There's nothing against Albanians or whatever.
It's against him.
But it was
he's an eye-gouging, murderous git.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he'd been convicted in his absence. He's gone back to Albania now. Then when I did another Albanian murder story, which embarrassed the Home Office a few weeks later. I mean, people have said, and this, I'm not here, I'm not criticising Albanians, or I don't want to be seen like that. In terms of your original question about risks,
I can't remember my question. Yeah, your answer's been that interesting. I've got lost in this.
No, what I'm saying is, you know, I think people will say to me, you know, in the police, just be careful with Albanian organized crime. You know, you mentioned the craze and that. The craze and some of those old big time villains wouldn't go for journalists. I am told, you know, not the same. Some of those gangsters.
It's the same with ISIS, isn't it? In the
State. Exactly. So it's a different, you know, so we have to assess the risk.
We had Raggy Omar in that chair a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying if you had a flak jacket with press on it a decade ago, you'd have been all right.
Really?
No one would have shot you.
Yeah.
Now it's a target. People want to kidnap you to put you in an orange jumpsuit to torture you live on YouTube.
I think I need body armour. I mean, after that Albanian doorstep in Boreham Wood, an ex-Met commander rang me. He said, I saw that video of a man online, but you weren't wearing body armour. I said, no. He said, well, God's sake, next time you're gonna, if you do anything like that, give me a call and I've got some old kit you can have. So he works in private security now or something. So. But yeah, it's dangerous. But, you know, that's, you know, I take my hat off to war reporters who, you know, put themselves far more in the firing line than I do.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation, very briefly, about how there was a time when you could ring police officers. And that brings me to my next question, which is about Leveson. You know, how has the job changed pre-Leveson to how it is now, post-Leveson?
Right. Well, I was crime editor of the Mail right up to about a year before Leveson. Informal contact obviously went on. We all know that.
Seems to me to be quite healthy.
Well, I would say so, but it was frowned upon, to put it mildly. Let me just tell you what I did. You know, I would call police officers. Police officers would call me. Sometimes I would ring with information about cases I was working on. Sometimes, can you believe it? I'd even ring them to say, you're going to get a kicking from me tomorrow.
This all seems quite gentlemanly
so far. Yeah. You're going to get a kicking from me tomorrow, and you might want to, you know, work out a strategy. You know, I'm not here to sort of score cheap points. So I would say, and this is what I said, told to a Leveson inquiry, there was a, you know, clearly some things were wrong, and there was over-familiarity and worse in some relationships. I'll defend all the relationships I had with people. I think I respect the most, or the fear, or some people dislike me. That's just, you know, don't really mind that. You're not here to make people you hold to account like you.
It's not a popularity contest.
No, it's not. No,
you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs.
No, so I mean, I, you know, I've got some. Blow my own trumpet, hopefully. Got some terrific stories which made a difference. People got sacked. People, corrupt police officers went to jail. I'm proud of that. My contribution to that.
But what's it like post-Leveson?
But now,
can you not ring police now and say?
Well, I mean, I think I'm disappointed. You know, post-Leveson, you know, the drawbridge went up, and all informal contact was frowned upon, banned. You know, I know a crime correspondent who bumped into a detective on the tube who suddenly got all panicky in case there's some CCTV of them having a conversation. In my own experience,
an excessive overcorrection.
You know, I will not name the individual. Where I live in London, a very senior London police officer lives, and, you know, during the Leveson inquiry, he was walking down the street on a Sunday morning coming back from the newsagents, as I was going to pick up the papers. And he went to the other side of the street to avoid walking past me. And I thought, you prat. I mean, for God's sake. You know, has it come to this?
It seems it has come to
this.
Well,
it did. In that particular moment, I think it's better now. And my colleague, Chris Greenberg, Chief Crime Correspondent, Chair of the Crime Force Association, which is trying to build bridges. We'll never be the same as it was before. But what I would argue is, and you get, when in the occasions when I do ring the police or press officers, you, and I hope I'm not being too unkind, you do get too many computer says no type responses these days. And can you look at our Twitter account? Can you look at our, you know, our website? And, you know, the famous one a few months ago during one of the terror attacks, you know, we're not here to answer questions. You know, something like that. It was just really, you know, these terror attacks, they've been very frenzied and very busy for press officers. But, you know, they are, you've got to remember that they're there to, you know, they're paid by the taxpayer and there to, of course, defend their organisations, also there to help the journalists as well. So the balance is, in a very waffly way, the balance is still wrong. And that's disappointing because I think that things, I mean, my hunch is there's a lot that's gone on in police and police forces which journalists don't know about these last few years because of that, the chilling effect of Leveson. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. I think, you know, a few years ago, the commissioner, the Met, Bernard Hogenhauer, said, you know, if staff have got a concern about an issue in the force, they should ring a hotline. See if someone's going to do that. They're going to grass up a colleague who's corrupt or doing something wrong. Not going to do that, are they?
It's ridiculous.
And they're not going to ring journalists now either. So I just don't think is the balance is the pendulum still too far the wrong side. So I feel quite passionate about that as a journalist.
But in terms of Leveson, you know, the Somme murders, Millie Dowler, they were pre-Leveson. Do you think you'd be able to expose as much as of the wrongdoing and the incompetence in the investigation where it was found post-Leveson? Would you be as free as you were before?
Well, I don't think I would be. And I hope that, you know, that's not sounding like someone who's trying to make excuses for not being able to get information in the present day. You know, I covered in 2002 Soho murders of Holly and Jessica. I mean, an appalling police investigation. It was so bad. It was so bad. You know, and, you know, it was difficult. They were a small force. You know, half the world's media, you know, literally turned up, and it was a complete fiasco.
I remember him being on Sky News.
Yeah, and I was at a press conference, the most bizarre press conference I've ever been to. It had some psychic going in the hedge next to the school where the press conference was, looking for clues about where Holly and Jessica were, and then the senior officer in the case looked into the camera and direct appeal to the abductor. I mean, sadly, obviously, they were found dead a few days later. It was complete chaos. Look, I rang a very senior officer in London and said, this is completely mad. They're completely overwhelmed. They haven't got a clue what's going on. The chief constable is on holiday. Within the next day, I'm not saying it's direct consequence of me, but you could have that contact. I could give an opinion.
And Millie Dowler, though, because that was one of the things that led to Leveson. Of
yeah,
course,
Millie Dowler. They were dreadfully let down by the police. I mean, the hacking scandal obviously is dreadful. What happened and what emerged, but what people forget, Paul, is that it was an appalling police investigation and a very basic door-to-door inquiries weren't done, and they had fatal consequences. Look, policing is difficult, and you mustn't rush to condemn. But in the cold light of day, that was an appalling police investigation. And, you know, I'm sorry. You know, before when the real killer, Leval Belfield, he's on trial for the murders he carried out after Millie. You know, I'm going to say I was really annoyed that Surrey Police were doing a spin operation with selected journalists, taking us out and trying to say that we did a good investigation on Millie. You know, I said, well, we had an hour with the senior officer and the press officer. And I said, well, I've heard what you've said, but I'm sorry. I've done my own investigation to this. This is a shocking inquiry. And I, you know, did a very hard-hitting, I think that's probably a polite way of putting it, piece in the paper when Belfield went down for the other murders. Subsequently, he was charged and convicted of Millie's murder, which is good. But I wouldn't have been able to write that. All the information I had was from a press officer and a senior officer.
But it's not anti-police to point out their shortcomings on a case-by-case basis. In fact, it's healthy for a democracy and a society that they can be held to account.
I would say so. With the police, with you know, notorious corrupt commander who I wrote about for 10 years.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, he was the police.
He was a wrong.
You know, police were terrified of him. They were terrified of him. And no way could I have done that campaign. I'll say campaign, but those series of articles exposing him if all the information I could get would be from a press officer. No way at all. And I, you know, anyone who doesn't think my reporting on the Ali Desai case wasn't a force for good, well, sorry, I think it was. I'm proud of that. Proud of that. He's a difficult person to take on. Post the McPherson inquiry, into Lawrence. You know, he played the race card. He was corrupt. He went to jail twice. But I don't, when I said this to Leveson, I don't think you could. I could have done that with the press banned from talking unofficially to police officers. I don't think, and I still don't think you could. If it was a modern day design, the police, you can get away with it at the moment, in my opinion.
You know, these instant demands of social media, does it make it harder for newspapers, you know, like the Mail, to commit to longer term crime investigations, the deep stuff? Because it costs a lot of money, it takes a long time. And also, is it changing the way that crime is being reported itself as well? I mean, look at that idiot Tommy Robinson stood outside the court calling people rapists as they walk, clearly in contempt.
Yes.
You know, these guys are not only doing proper journalism, but also putting justice at risk.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, the nature of a lot of the newspaper websites is to get it out quickly. So I'm not condemning our paper's website, not at all. But we live in an era where things happen, news spreads very quickly, and it's that instant demand for news. And I think that, going back to the original question, yeah, I mean, I have a concern, but I think it's not just about crime. My view is the websites and internet are still finding themselves, and you know, at the moment, our website is different to the newspaper, and I imagine there's going to be some merging in due course. Not merging as in, you know, website and the paper physically, but I mean in terms of how investigations are covered, and for the benefit of both the paper and the website.
Do you think the Daily Mail is an easy target? I mean, you know, what is the biggest public misconception about the way the Mail conducts its journalism? You must know that the Daily Mail gets attacked more vociferously than any other newspaper in the UK. Is some of that unfair? Is all of it unfair?
You know, going back to the point I made a few minutes ago, you know, we're not here, journalists, to please everyone. You can't do that. You know, the paper has got bite, continues to have bite, and you're going to upset some people. I will defend it. I've been in the paper 25 years, so it's not surprising that I would say that some of the criticism's unfair, exaggerated, but you have to look at where it's coming from.
No newspaper's perfect.
No, but
biggest tribute I could pay is I buy the Daily Mail every day. I run a PR agency. We buy a lot of the papers.
Yeah.
I always read the Mail. It's ubiquitous.
Yeah, I some of the criticism's irritating because I don't think it's deserved. But there are people who, you know, we could, sometimes I think some of the people who criticise the paper, you know, we could save the world from World War III and they'd still find a way to criticise it, such as their dislike of the paper. There's nothing you can do about that. You know, just there's nothing to do about that. You know, I think the paper's done some very positive things, has done during my time. Of course, there'll be occasions when the paper gets it wrong, with judgment's wrong. It'd be silly to say otherwise. But you know, I think you know, very loyal member of staff, and you know, we've got some terrific journalists, young, middle aged, and old. And they're really hardworking professional journalists, and you know, it's a terrific team, and people who could, in my opinion, I'm not talking about myself, definitely not talking about myself, you know, walk into jobs in most other newspapers because they're that good, that bright, and that driven.
What's the newsroom like now that Paul Dacre's gone? I mean, he was an institution. He was there years and years and years.
Business as usual. I don't...
Come on, spill the beans.
No, it may be a bit quieter, some people say. I will not pass comment. But,
do you have to? You don't have to dodge any staplers now. Or is that apocryphal? Was that myth? Was that a legend?
I have no knowledge of such instances. You certainly never threw anything at me. So I could have thrown a few more plaudits on occasions, possibly. The Daily Mail, to get to base camp is not to be criticised. Anything thereafter is a bonus.
So. That was very well handled. If I had the skill of Paxman and you were Michael Howard, I'd ask you the same question kind of seven times. No, but in one sense, though, I think for all of his faults, Paul Dacre was an incredibly tough editor, and he delivered a product that was widely admired by its readership to the point where they actually bought it consistently, daily, for decades.
I would say this, two things on that issue. Firstly, doesn't matter how tough your boss is. If your boss knows what he wants, it's a lot easier than a demanding boss who doesn't know what he wants. I'm not, you know, so in that respect, I'm not saying it's been easy to work for him or his regime, but he knew what he wanted. You know, he has assembled a very good team. One of the successes of the paper, I'm stating the obvious here, is it knows its market. And that's another thing which annoys me when the usual suspects criticise the paper, because our readership is big and people love the paper and they love the website. You know, some person who's got an axe to grind against the paper is slagging off the paper. They're slagging off our readership.
So. But it must be, you know, and this applies to any newspaper, but when you get a new editor, is it a bit like a tapestry where you pull on one of the strings and the whole thing could unravel? Because already there's, some are saying there's a slight, there's a softening on Brexit. You know, I doubt you'd run a splash calling the Supreme Court Lords traitors in Ermine and things like this. Maybe these changes might be for the better.
I'm going to bottle that
question. You might think that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Yeah, no, it's not my position to comment on that. I think all papers evolve. The previous editor was very demanding, wanted to be successful. The new editor will have his own way of doing it. What I can say is, having been there so long, he's got to have a terrific team around him and everyone will be supporting him. So business as usual, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't blame you for taking the fifth. I also know that I'd get a lot of grief on social media if I didn't at least try a couple of times to get you
well,
to...
Well, you can try again if you want. No, try in a different way, you know. It's not, you know, that's the truth. I mean, it's, you know...
What's next for you? I mean, you've been doing this job a long time. It might be. You might be about to say, I've no plans to change. I want to do it for another 25 years.
I don't know. I mean, I still get a buzz out of getting a great story.
Well, you're in long trade if you don't.
Yeah, I do. So I'm always looking ahead and don't like to live in the past. Some years ago, after the Lawrence case, a few people said, you can dine out on this one for the rest of your life now. I said, absolutely no chance. No chance at all. I don't think there's nothing worse in journalism than arrogance and complacency. No chance of that. You look to the future. So... I'm, you know, there are things that I want to do in the future, but I'm happy in what's a more difficult environment to work in than it ever has been because of privacy laws, libel, strict libel laws, data protection laws. You know, the odds are stacked against us if you want to take on bad people, but that makes it more challenging.
Stephen, it's been an incredible conversation. I could honestly have gone for another two or three more hours, but we're going to get thrown out of the studio. So I just have to say thank you ever so much for your time. It's been amazing.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.